It's 9 o'clock, and we're gonna start with a roll call.
City of Blythe, City of Cathedral City, City of Coachella.
Present.
City of Desert Hot Springs, City of Indian Wells, City of Indio.
Present.
City of La Quinta, I believe Mayor Pro Tem Pena is here and is being moved. He is on the phone. City of Palm Desert.
Here, and it looks like Indian Wells is joining.
I will double back after their audio is connected. Thank you. City of Palm Springs.
Hi, it's Christy. I'm here just by audio today.
City of Rancho Mirage.
Here.
Riverside County.
Here.
And City of Indian Wells. And City of La Quinta.
Present, audio only.
Chair, you have a quorum.
Okay, we have a quorum. We're going to move on to our Pledge of Allegiance. So I'm going to ask everyone who is available to stand up and place your right hand over your heart, and I'll lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Go ahead and place your right hand over your heart. Ready, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, could the record show Indian Wells is present?
Yes, we got you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, this time is set aside a public comment for public to address the committee on agenda items. At the discretion of the chair, comments may take at the time items are presented are limited to 3 minutes. I'm going to ask the attendees to raise their hand or press *9 if they'd like to make a public comment. Erica, do we have any public comments?
You have a raised hand, Chair.
Okay.
And they should have, Chief Getz, you should have audio access.
Good morning, Public Safety Committee members. My name is Blake Getz, retired Fire Chief of Palm Springs and recently Interim Chief of Cathedral City as of last week. I'm here to comment on item 8C, the earthquake education early warning system put out by Shake Alert. And I want to encourage everyone to support that measure that they have. It's an app on your phone to allow early warning to be received by those that have GPS enabled on their phone. It's a good thing, especially along with the education program. We've been striving for earthquake education in the Valley for many, many years. As some of you may or may not know, I was an ex officio member of this committee for close to 10 years, and we formed the CRUSE program, Coachella Valley Earthquake Warning System. Currently, we have 20 independent earthquake warning sensors, 14 in fire stations, 2 at Sunline, and 4 in dispatch centers. Our goal to create a widespread network was to network those together, add a bunch more, and cover 82 schools with 80,000 students and all public facilities in the Valley here with up to 30 seconds of warning. This program is being adopted. We weren't able to pull it off because we needed funding for it. It happened right after the recession. But the City of Thousand Oaks and Santa Clarita are looking into it, and the San Ramon Fire District in the Bay Area is implementing it now, the same program. So I would encourage you to keep this item as a goal for this committee. The technology is there to provide actionable earthquake warning with no false positives and beat the quake, the shaking, as I should say, to the surface. And it can save lives. So this education program that Shake Alert and My Shake app has is good, but it is not going to activate your fire station doors. And it may come after the shaking actually starts, has been proven in many other areas of the state. So that concludes my comments, and I'm open for any questions you may have or willing to come in at another meeting and talk more about our project. Thank you.
Okay, I have a question.
Just one question. You mentioned that it will not activate fire station doors. How will those be taken care of? And when you mentioned also the 30-second, possible up to 30-second warning, I presume that would be in Northern California, and the seconds would lessen as it moves down toward the desert here?
No, actually, so two questions. The ones that are currently in the fire stations now, the 14, they will open the doors of the fire stations currently as they sit. Palm Springs has 5, Rancho Mirage has their stations, and Cal Fire has the rest throughout the valley, 2 at Sunline, and 4 in the dispatch centers. That's Indio, Palm Springs, Cathedral City, and Beaumont. So you can get the 30 seconds from a Salton Sea earthquake all the way to Beaumont would be 30 seconds. So we don't have to go as far as Northern California, because the system is not intended to activate if it's a small intensity event. So by distance, the shaking will slowly diminish, and by the time it hits us, it's not going to activate. These are set for about a 4, 4.5 magnitude, and that's what we're expecting in the valley. They've proven themselves, and we put the first one in Palm Springs in 2001, and the thing is activated every single time it's happened on a 4 or larger earthquake. The most recent one was an Anza earthquake, only a few miles from Station 4, and we got 3 seconds of warning at that fire station. It did activate the doors. It did alert the annunciation within the station, but these are expensive systems, so that the project, as they're being evolved now, are for fire stations and city facilities to host sensors, distribute the signal out to the community via simple earthquake network-enabled devices, like in the schools, that then ties into the PA system so that the students can drop cover and hold on, and before the shaking actually starts. So the technology is proven, it's working. This Cal OES state system is simply an app on your phone that will warn you when an earthquake happens based on their instruments that are in the ground. And there's some problems with that, because we found that in, say, the Northridge earthquake, all the red tag buildings after that earthquake would not have
received. Mr. Goat, your time is up, but what we'd like to do, if possible, is bring it to item 8C and we could discuss it there.
Very good.
Right. Thank you for your time. Thank you, and thank you for your question. We'll move along to Chair and CVAC comments. If any staff or have any comments for this meeting, our committee members that they would like to share.
Chair, I just wanted to take a minute and introduce myself. I think most, if not all, elected officials know me, but some of our police and fire chiefs may not. I'm Erica Felci. As you will see in your information items, we are doing some transition with the CV Housing First program, which is taking quite a bit of Tom Cox's time. So I have the pleasure of joining you at these meetings and will hopefully become an even more familiar face to you over the course of the year. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Erica. Do you have any hands raised?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Hi, I wanted to say thank you to everyone for the election last meeting. The one meeting I miss in about 2 years is the election in which everyone elected me vice chair. So I wanted to thank everyone for that. I'm very excited to continue working in this committee, and now even closer partnership with Chair Furman to keep us moving forward. Thank you.
And I'd like to finish that with thanking everyone and for electing me for chair. As you all know, or probably don't know, my passion is in public safety, and I'm a people person, so I like working with folks. So it's an honor to chair this committee for this next fiscal year, and looking forward to doing some great things. So we'll move along to ex officio updates. If you raise your hand, we could get you for some comments. Any ex officio updates out there?
I see none at this time, Chair.
Okay, no hands are raised. So we'll move on to consent calendar. If I could get a motion for consent calendar.
Approved. Second. Indian Wells, second.
I didn't get who made the motion.
I made the motion, Chair.
Okay. Councilmember Jacinto, motion to pass consent calendar. Second by Indian Wells. Do we get a roll call?
Chair, you can ask for a consensus vote unless there are any no's or abstentions.
Well, I'd like to ask for a consensus vote, if that's possible. We all nod or wave our hand. Okay. Looks like it passes, Erica. Okay. We'll introduce the next item, which is discussion action items. The first item, I believe, will be a COVID-19 update by Jeff Van Wagenen of Riverside County. It's on you, Jeff.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Last time I gave an update, it had been several months, and so I had to do a big, deep dive. Hopefully this time it'll be a little less intense for everybody. But I always start my updates with an update on the response. As of yesterday, November 8th, there were 71,281 confirmed cases in Riverside County. The death total as of yesterday was 1,338. The total recovered, and that's a caveat or an asterisk, is 63,216. The reason why there's an asterisk there is because recovered is relative. A number of folks like myself had minor symptoms and were back at work right when our isolation ended. Other folks are being tagged with what's been called the long haul and lingering effects from this disease. Our hospitalization numbers as of November 8th, COVID positive currently in our jail, 223. Of that number, 62 are in our ICU. As a reminder, we have 3,483 licensed hospital beds and 411 licensed ICU beds. We have seen an increase over the last 30 days, but we are still half of what we were seeing in July. Moving on to recovery and the state's blueprint for California. These are the weekly numbers as of November 4th. But remember, that's a 7-day average with a 7-day lag. So the numbers that we are reflecting are from the week ending October 24th. Our tier assignment is purple. Our actual case rate is 11.5. We tested it during that time frame, 236 individuals per day per 100,000. The state median was 239. That means our adjusted case rate was the same as our actual case rate, which is 11.5. I'll talk a little bit more about testing in a moment. Our testing positivity for the week ending October 24th was 5.9%, which places us in the red. Our internal county numbers, which are not yet official until we get it from the state, shows that we are seeing our numbers continue to increase week over week. The health equity metric, which is something I think we briefly touched on last meeting. The short version is this: as a county, we can only move as one, and we can only move as fast as the slowest among us. So the health equity metric is focused on the lowest quartile HPI, Healthy Place Index, by census tracts. The lowest HPI are those communities with high poverty, lack of access to healthcare, and challenges related to obtaining food, housing, public transportation, et cetera. That means that for the lowest HPI for us to move to red, the test positivity rate must also be 8%, which is the same as the rest of the county. The good news is that our numbers as of November 4th shows that the lowest HPI test positivity is 7.5%. What does this mean overall for everything? Over the last month, our numbers have been moving in the wrong direction. We are seeing this across the state, across the country, and across the world. We need to get to a case rate at or below 7 per 100,000 and then stay there for 2 weeks. So as a county, what are our next steps? We are continuing to focus on increasing testing in the community. I want to remind everybody of what our three goals are as it relates to testing. First and foremost, from a public health perspective, we want to get an accurate picture of the spread of the disease. By getting our testing numbers up to the state median, we have accomplished that. Number two is, as it relates to the blueprint, we wanted to stop getting penalized for our low testing numbers. We were getting cases added to our case rate, in essence, because we were testing below the state median. We have now accomplished that by reaching the state median. Finally, our third goal is to start getting rewarded for high testing numbers. Just as you get penalized for low numbers, you get a benefit for increasing testing. For example, in Orange County, this last go round, their case rate went from 6.1 to 6.0. San Diego went from 8.7 down to 7.4. and Los Angeles County went from 12.5 down to 7.5. So we have an interest as a community to make sure that we are testing and testing above the state median. I want to thank our partners, including all of the cities on this call and CVAG generally. As a result of our joint effort over the last 30 days, we have increased our testing numbers countywide exponentially. What is the current push from the county? We have created a testing task force involving cities, businesses, nonprofits, and it's coordinated by County Emergency Management Department. We're also working with the state twofold. One, to access their increased testing capacity since they brought the Perkins Elmer Lab in Valencia online, which will also result in quicker turnaround of our testing. We've also asked for 4 more additional mobile teams, which would bring our state total of 8 mobile teams to the county, which would be in addition to the county's 4 drive-through test sites. We're also working, and I know a number of the cities are working as well, with a vendor to secure self-administered PCR tests, which will, again, increase our capacity and turnaround time. We're also not giving up on antigen testing and having to figure out a way to have those tests, which typically folks can pick at point of care or even the CVS, have those included in our numbers. Currently, they are not. We're also continuing to implement our focused action plan. By that, we're supporting community-based organizations in our harder-to-reach communities, and we're continuing our outreach with faith-based organizations. We have expanded the use of our business ambassador program, and our Board of Supervisors recently has taken action, two items specifically. One is they have renewed our partnership with Orange County, San Diego, and San Bernardino counties to focus on a regional response, and also a broad review of the spectrum of scientific and public health options and approaches to make sure that every best practice is implemented locally. We are increasing our advocacy also with the Urban Counties Caucus, trying to convince the state to have a static testing number as opposed to what they now have as the sliding median number. The reason why that's important is as our tests increase, it drives the state median up. So we're always going to be chasing that number a little bit. And if our hope is to surpass that state median or state testing number, we want it to be static. We're also focused on advocating for post-CARES funding for both testing and contact tracing and for business and community support. As a reminder, the current CARES Act funds expire December 30th. And so much of our efforts on both fronts, both on the public health response and the economic response, are dependent on additional dollars. We're also advocating the state to allow us safe reopening decisions to be made based on data and also consideration of our hospitalization capacity. Our essential county services continue on behalf of all of our residents. I would point folks to the county website for this effort, www.rivcoph.org/coronavirus, and Chair, that is the end of my report, and I can certainly answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Van Wagenen. Do we have any questions for him? No? Okay. Well, thank you for the update. Hopefully we could continue to get those numbers down and mitigate the spread of COVID-19. We know this is very dangerous, and I have some friends and coworkers who are battling this awful disease right now. So we're praying that we can get these numbers down. So thank you for your report. So moving on to item B, to update on countywide efforts to address green waste. Erica, will you be handling this?
Sure, Chair, thank you very much. I'm here to introduce Chief Fish. Some of the longstanding members of this committee may recall that this was a topic that came to you last year, and the county has made some progress. And it's certainly timely given yesterday's news on the fire front. And Chief Fish is here to provide you an update on some of the task force efforts that are underway. Chief, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, everyone. Robert Fish, I'm a division chief with the Riverside County Fire Department. I serve the Eastern Desert area and am a founding member, of the Combustible Materials Task Force. And Erica, will you be sharing my PowerPoint, or do you want me to do that from my side?
You can, or if you're having issues, we can have Oscar.
Nope,
I believe you should have all controls. Thank you.
Okay, so I have just a brief, about 5 to 10 minute update for the group. And first of all, I'd like to start off with is that when we initially started this process about 18 months ago in July of 2019, it initially was just the county fire department and code enforcement with the assistance of county council. In the process of building relationships, one of the things that we've been able to do is actually bring a number of other collaborating agencies, and forgive me because I failed to also include Department of Environmental Health on the county side, but we've also expanded our membership in the task force to include AQMD, Department of Waste, and we also have some additional agencies that aren't directly involved on the task force, but are contributing members like the Bureau of Reclamation, Bureau of Land Management, and some of our tribal partners, including Torres Martinez Indian Reservation and some of the Agua Caliente folks. So they have assisted us in a number of ways, but generally what I'd like to just say and to relay is that one of the strengths has been the building of relationships in tearing down walls that silo us in, and finding that when we work together in a cooperative and coordinated manner, we actually have quite a bit of enforcement capability. It's just about understanding each other's individual capabilities. So with that, in general, our numbers will, and I'll get into a slide next that breaks down some of this, but we have 54 properties that have been referred to the task force, and those referrals have come through a number of mechanisms, primarily fire department crews who are responding on a daily basis, but also the use of our CAL FIRE law enforcement teams and community reports. And anytime we get a referral, we go through an inspection process. That information is relayed to code enforcement. And depending on if it's on private land or in farmland, it will determine who is necessary to inspect it, because some of the rules that we've learned is it gets quite convoluted. If you have private land with no farm activity, it only falls under code enforcement. But if you have a farm that has these types of issues, then it's a Department of Environmental Health issue. And then there are also tangent responsibilities for AQMD. So the rules get quite complicated and convoluted, and this is one of the things that we've really had an opportunity to kind of dive deep into. As a result of that, of those 54, 18 were found with no violations, and 29 were found with violations that then went through various processes. 13 of those came with issued cease and desist letters. And of those 13, 11 came into compliance and two failed, where we used county council and superior court to provide restraining orders against those properties. So generally, I would say most of the time when we make contact with property owners, we're able to assist them through education and coming into compliance, and that generally most folks become compliant. It's the rarity so far is the failure to come into compliance, which is good for us. So this just breaks down that information in a slightly different way. And specifically the area that's in the salmon color, you can actually see how those cases broke down specifically with county council and the progress they went through. And again, what I want to do is reinforce with the group that our work through education and outreach has been probably one of the more effective sides, but that when necessary, the tools of government can help us achieve the outcome of compliance when necessary. So just to let you know, while we are making progress, there are significant problems that still exist. On a regular basis, we're discovering new problems. This is the Garnett fire, which is in the same location. This is actually 2 weeks ago. So the fire that occurred yesterday, this is at the same location. And as you can see, it's multiple acres of not just a junkyard, but also decades, I'm estimating decades because it's a lot of material that has accumulated there in the desert. And when fire is introduced, especially under the wind conditions that we had two weeks ago, it was slightly different because we were under a Santa Ana condition. But then yesterday, because of the weather front moving through, obviously we had very accelerated winds that pushed the fire in a very aggressive manner, it makes it difficult to deal with. So while this is was our task force was initially established to deal with problems in the southern Coachella Valley, one of the things that I think we've come to realize is that the problem is actually widespread. It's not just in the southern Coachella Valley, but as we start to develop relationships, we're getting more and more reports of things that are all over the county. This one being in the North Palm Springs area, just south of, north of the city limits of Palm Springs and south of the city limits of Desert Hot Springs. But this is an example of another fire that occurred in the city of Lake Elsinore. Well, actually it's in the county areas, in the El Toro area of Lake Elsinore. And the reason I share these pictures with you is to give you an idea of the scale of how much material is there. This is a site where an individual was, the claim is that they are using the material for land modification for farming purposes. But there's no farming going on, and you can see that it would take literally hundreds and hundreds of dump loads of material. And so this is an instance that came to us as a result of a fire, repeated fires in the Lake Elsinore area. So the issue is not just isolated to the southern Coachella Valley, is essentially the what I'm relaying. And in addition to that, a number, about 2 years ago, we had a fairly large scale mulch fire in the Sage area. So I think the reality is that while our efforts are focused primarily on the southern Coachella Valley, the reality is that there is a systemic problem probably countywide that's gone unrecognized that we're starting to scratch the surface on. This is an example of a fire that we had in the thermal area at Avenue 58. To give you kind of a scale, this is just one side. This is 12 acres of Wind Road combustible, it was grinded pond frond material. And just to give you an idea that it just, once it's well involved like this, it requires an enormous amount of resources and equipment to actually extinguish the fire. Fortunately, unlike with the Martinez 3 fire, we were able to, in the course of 2 days, mitigate this so that the majority of the smoke impact to the Coachella Valley was mitigated. But the first day, if you, those of you from that might've been in the valley that day are probably well aware that it was very thick and the humidity levels were high. So it was very much like an inversion layer with fog that impacted all the communities. So one of the other things I wanted to speak on, because this was a result of, besides the additional funding for the code enforcement officers, which have allowed us in code to focus folks specifically on these problems, one of the other things that additional funding allowed was for the assignment of a CAL FIRE law enforcement officer to the Lower Valley. And that law enforcement officer is a fully sworn, post-certified fire investigator, but he also has complete policing community powers. So one of the things that we've seen the benefit of him is by engaging with the community and specifically some of the homeless community that are in these areas that are chronic fire starters, that by a community and policing approach and developing relationships with the people in the community, we've been able to get tips, we've been able to get information, we've been able to do enforcement via education, and had a very specifically in the Mecca thermal area, a very significant reduction in homeless caused fires by removing a lot of the chronic fire starters from the community through law enforcement efforts. But in addition to that, this position also conducts an enormous amount of intel and recon for the task force and relays that information through me. And we've been testing some other technology to actually drop pins directly to code enforcement officers as he's doing his patrol and enforcement when he comes across places that are off the beaten path that information can be relayed. And in addition to that, the assigned officer is also collaborating with local law enforcement, including the sheriffs, and with some of our partners with BLM and Bureau of Reclamation as well. So finally, some of our ongoing, it's not all doom and gloom, though what I wanna leave the group with is that we're scratching the surface of the problem. This will be This is a generations-based problem. It was created over a generation. It will probably take us a generation to adapt and to mitigate it. But the picture here in the upper left corner is what it looks like after we've mitigated and once, you know, the rules have come into compliance. Mulch is allowed to be used within the community for dust suppression and land modification, but obviously there are limits to that, and we need to continue our efforts. So some of our ongoing goals is to continue to bring awareness to the issue, continue to strengthen the collaboration and the work efforts, and strengthen our workflows with one another. We seem to be having great success with that. I think the relationship building and understanding, again, what each other is able to assist with has been very powerful for us to know how to improve the efficiency of moving these things through the system or the individual cases through the system. And then we want to continue to do compliance via education. We want to do continued community outreach because the greatest partners we have are the community, because the community is the ones that are most effective when we have these fires. And then we also want to continue, as I've raised with the group previously, explore possibilities of a coordinated city county policy approach to some of these problems. If we could align county policy and the individual city policies together in a way that puts downward pressure on a lot of the perverse incentives to dump green waste into the community, then that would be a benefit to everyone. One additional thing that was brought to my attention by the Department of Environmental Health is that Cathedral City actually has applied for a green waste facility in the Edom Hill area. That's going through an approval process that I don't understand very well, but my understanding is it is a multiple year process, but there is additional capacity coming theoretically to the Valley in the coming years. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. I am happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your presentation, Chief Fish. You know, thank you for your firefighters out there fighting these fires on the front line. And by the looks of your presentation, it's apparent that it's going to be a collaborative effort amongst all cities and local municipalities to fight these fires. So thank you for that. And I think we have a hand raised. Councilmember Betts has a question or comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. By the way, I was able to take care of the emergency. My 93-year-old mother had gotten down on her knees to pray and then called and said she couldn't get up off the floor. So I had to race over there and help her. So I'm back, as you can see. I'm gonna go out on a limb here and guess that fire at the Garnet and that dump at the Garnet is not a permitted landfill. And that the county's doing something to search those out. And from the presentation, it sounded like that's been there for years, a decade or more. Is that correct?
Well, specifically what I understand about that site, the green waste site is something that's relatively new within the last few years that I'm aware of. It sounds like the property owner, where there is an existing what we call a junkyard, I guess, is the best way to describe it, that the county has actually previously gone in there and performed mitigation efforts, but then the issue has returned over a period of time. Again, part of this, and I'm speaking on behalf of Code, so you'll have to forgive me because that's not my area of expertise, but what I do know is that not only is there a legal process, but there's also a funding mechanism that's at issue here as well, which if you identify and go through the legal process, there still has to be the funds to actually go through the legal process. So I don't want to overspeak on that, but I know there are competing interests and reasons why there are challenges for, you know, these types of problems throughout the county.
So the last question would be, you were talking about, you know, public outreach. If people see something starting, then there's a number, there's a place where they can call to let you know about it. If they see mulch being dumped or limbs or debris gathering?
Yes, sir. We actually have a hotline that goes to code enforcement. That's on a number of media that we have developed, not only online, but anytime we do any type of media like physical media with the news agencies or radio stations. It's also on flyers that we distribute in and around the communities. Those efforts have been primarily focused on the Southern Coachella Valley, not areas like North Palm Springs, because historically that has not been a problem area with fire.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, is that something, the number of contact information that staff could get to us?
I believe we could handle that, Erica, correct?
Great, thank you.
I can provide that. Yes. I don't have it with me, but I can provide it to Erica as soon as we're completed.
We will distribute it to all the committee members.
Thank you.
Okay. Erica, do we have any other hands raised?
We do, and I also want to note for the record that Councilman Mark Carnevale is here from Cathedral City as well. We have two hands raised from Councilwoman Unicinto and Mayor Pro Tem Kelly.
Okay, Councilman Jacinto.
Good morning, Chief. Thanks for that presentation. Very important work, and it's really good to have the update. I was really interested to hear you mention the benefit that could be had by aligning policies in the cities to match the county. And I was wondering if you already have sort of a grasp of what those best policies or best practices are, or if we could possibly bring you back in the future to suggest some improvements in city policies as far as preventing or addressing dumping kind of further up the chain, and then preventing these fires, so that we can look at a city level what we can be doing to get in the game and to help prevent this.
So to answer your question, I do not have sample legislation for anyone at the moment. A lot of that is something that we've talked about in theory. The problem is we're trying to balance the need to, again, decrease the perverse incentives for why this activity is happening, which is it's saving individual companies time and money. Most of this product is not coming from the Southern Valley. It's coming from the more affluent areas up Valley, specifically for the Coachella Valley. It's landscapers and other types of agricultural businesses that are doing business. That are then generally dumping it in places where they don't have to pay fees or meet certain regulations. With that being said, I know that, for example, the city of La Quinta has a process where there is an attachment or a process where in order to get a business license, they have to actually show to some degree their permitted disposal of green waste. I don't know that many of the other cities have similar efforts, but if the cities and the county were to be able to theoretically come together in an architecture that for any individual landscaper to do business, they would have to show these logs, this disposal that was commensurate with the amount of work they're doing, and create penalties that were stiff enough that it made them fearful of getting caught, it would probably go a long ways in diminishing our problems. But at the same time, that in my view, one of the things we certainly don't want to do is hurt or damage small business in the process. So it's about finding a balance, and you as the policymakers are in a much better position to decide what that balance is. But it is about balance between enforcement and penalties versus working with our businesses together. And understand that it's my view that based upon the experience with our enforcement piece, that it's not all businesses, unfortunately, but there are definitely businesses out there that do that. And it's actually part of the culture of the Southern Valley as well. On some of these fires, I'll give you an example, the Avenue 58 fire, while we were there actively fighting fire, folks from the community were coming in to dump their waste as we were there. So I mean, to them, it's just, to those individuals, this was no big deal because this is what they've come to expect as being okay. That's part of the process that we need to continue to educate the community that this has a negative impact on the places that they live, and that we need to help them come to the realization to push away from that and not allow it to occur in their communities.
I have a suggestion, if I may. If staff can continue to work with Chief Fish and get some of this information out to our all of our council members, and so we could relay this information to our cities and how we could help our cities to mitigate these fires. Councilmember Kelly, do you have a question?
Yes, that's a great suggestion. I want to ask a question, which probably doesn't have an answer today, but it strikes me as a very important question to keep before us. Chief, when you said that this is a problem that built up over a generation, the question that came to me was, what problem are we ignoring in this generation that's currently building up? So I don't know if you have an immediate reaction as to whether there's another front where lack of public action or lack of public will or lack of coordinated responses allowing something to fester. But I do want to keep that question before us, because if somebody had been asking 20 years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
With all due respect, ma'am, I think I'd have to think about that one a little bit. I don't know that that's the question I necessarily want to answer off the cuff. As related to our current situation with combustible materials, excuse me, what I would say is that 15 years ago, maybe a little bit longer now, there was a concerted effort that was focused on areas of the Torres Martinez reservation land, where many of the same agencies, along with the federal government and many federal agencies, got together to mitigate problems at the Duros Mobile Home Park and the dump that was there off of Pierce Street. A very collaborative and combined effort came together to mitigate that problem. Once the problem was mitigated, over the time, those folks moved on, retired, promoted, went to other places. One of the things I would recommend for us as a collaborative group is finding a way to sustain this effort, because it will take many years to continue to reduce the impact of these issues, because to some degrees it's whack-a-mole. We solve the problem here, but they just go to a different field or a different place right now. So sustaining, so that the current members of the task force, that those become transformative in the process rather than just reactional right now, that in 5 years, when all of us are no longer in our current positions, that the next ones of us are still carrying on the effort in some sort of coordinated effort.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Fish.
I have a question also.
We don't want to lose our quorum, so we want to try to move through these items, and then maybe we can revisit it at the end if we have time.
Okay. I just have one question. Are any of these dumping areas fenced off?
Yes, many of them are secured properties that are unattended properties. Some are not. It is a mixed bag of goods when it comes to that, because many of these are in the wildland areas.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you for your presentation, Chief Fish. Next item will be earthquake education and early warning system, and Tom Cox will be handling this.
And Chair, perhaps in the interest of time, I will introduce Emily Holland as former Chief Getz noted at the beginning of the meeting. We do have some information from the state and some early warning. And I personally downloaded the app and this weekend, and it is user friendly if I can figure it out. So with that, thank you, Emily, for joining us.
Thank you all so much for having me. I wanted to just share a presentation and really appreciate the longstanding interest in this activity from the area, and the fact that you guys have had many projects already in place. We are always about making sure that all projects and all forms of getting warnings out there are made available. And I'm just going to talk about a few that the state has been most intimately involved in. We are starting with the Don't Get Caught Off Guard campaign that has started in within the month of October. And it is building up over many years of work on earthquake early warning. Part of the program is that it helps have different ways to distribute earthquake early warning. And we also talk about other ways that we can have, as was mentioned earlier, projects like fire doors open automatically and first responders be alerted via radio. And all of the information about this program is available at earthquake.ca.gov. The earthquake early warning system that we have in the state is actually done by a combination of efforts. It's not just Cal OES, but it's also working with USGS, the California Department of Conservation, the UC Berkeley Seismic Lab, and Caltech. So all of the partners work together on making sure that the sensor network works efficiently. And throughout the state, we, by the end of the implementation process, we'll have 1,115 sensors spaced evenly throughout the state. They are more tightly clustered in urban areas and areas that have the most seismic activity, and then more largely distributed in the rural areas. And this is part of the sensor network that powers the statewide system. We also wanted to highlight the sensors that we have in place near Coachella and also their relation to the fault areas. So these are ones that I am not sure now if they are done in any way in conjunction with the system that was spoken about earlier, but these are the statewide sensors that were operated by either Caltech or USGS, which tie into the statewide system. There are some examples, in addition to fire station doors, about how earthquake early warning using the shake alert messaging system are implemented into real life projects. One of the earliest was in BART and using to slow and stop trains. We also have high school applications into PA systems. And Cedars-Sinai is one of the largest hospital projects that shows how alerts can be given to doctors so they can choose how to respond to their patients. One of the ones, and thanks so much, Erica, for downloading it over the weekend, but we have the MyShake app, which was developed in coordination with UC Berkeley. And the state came in and provided funding to help scale it to the capability to alert the public. In addition to just giving you alerts from the statewide system, there's research being done to where we can actually increase the amount of warning people get. So using many, many phones that are stagnant to help crowdsource the information about the first waves of the earthquake before we actually feel the larger, more impactful ones. We also have partnered with Google and USGS to produce Android earthquake alerts. So now, as of August, any new phone that has a new Android operating system update or a new phone will, on the device without using the app, provide you with earthquake alerts. And this is reaching a much larger percent of the population. I think as many of you are all very familiar, it's much easier to reach more people with opt-out formats than opt-in. We also are using wireless emergency alerts, and I wanted to highlight that there are different thresholds. Since they're still somewhat opt-in for the Android and MyShake, those are gonna happen when earthquakes are at least 4.5 magnitude, and they will go out to anyone who would feel light shaking. We have been releasing wireless emergency alerts for the past year that are released when there's a magnitude 5.0 earthquake, and they will go to anyone who's going to feel light shaking. So these are automatically being sent out by USGS, and they're actually one of the first automatic alerts in the nation. Most of the others, like amber or silver alerts, are actually entered into a system. This happens automatically because time is so sensitive. Just wanting to provide, all of you are very aware, but we always like to provide just a brief reminder of different scenarios. Unfortunately, we are not always at our desks or have a place to get under a table. But the instances of, if you're in bed, don't get out. You can hurt yourself in the process, but put a something over your head. And we are constantly trying to remind people that a doorway is no safer because the door could hit you. But to actually get the main point of that is we don't want things to fall on your head because that's the most likely chance of injury. We just have a kind of a three-step reminder for the program to download the app and check your phone settings, visit earthquake.ca.gov for information about these resources, along with all of our partners and their great educational materials. And we're really thankful for opportunities like this to get to talk to groups and help spread the word and answer questions. And great, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great, Ms. Holland. Do we have any questions for Ms. Holland, Erica? Well, I have a comment. I work in Imperial County at a state institution, and I'm in a tower half the time. So what do I do when we have an earthquake cluster and I'm in a four-story tower? I can't run anywhere.
I have great faith in the building codes within the state of California, so you should stay where you are and get under your desk, because the likelihood of it collapsing is much lower here than anywhere else.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your previous...
Stay away from windows. Windows okay. is another thing. If you're close to windows, you might want to move a little bit away because glass is an issue.
All righty. So thank you for your presentation, and I will download the app. This was just a presentation, not an action item. So we'll move on to item D, which is a valley-wide conversation on race, diversity, and policing. I will lead us into this, and it's adopting a resolution. And in the interest of time, I'm going to cut my comments down, but I will keep the substance. And throughout this last year, we've had many conversations, many Zoom meetings with community organizers, activists, our law enforcement community, and elected officials. And I want to thank our CVAC staff. I want to thank all of our police departments, all of our chiefs, our sheriff. I also want to thank our faith-based community, our fire rescue, Congressman Ruiz, Riverside County Supervisor Perez. And if I missed anyone, I'm sorry. There was a lot of folks that took who took part in these conversations. And I really believe they were very productive. And I also want to thank our ad hoc committee for taking the time to work on this resolution. I think it came out great. And my goal with the resolution was to acknowledge and condemn excessive and unnecessary use of force, racial injustices, and violence towards law enforcement personnel, while applauding great activism work, good policing, and maintaining public safety and enhancing unity in our communities. Our missions aren't designed to conflict, and we are strong together. And I think these conversations are going to bring us together. And I wanted to bring our police chiefs and everyone in this meeting in on this discussion, because everyone has a different perspective, but I believe all perspectives are right. And if we listen to each other, I think we can move forward in a great positive direction. Like I said, while maintaining our public safety and enhancing our unity. So I don't know, is Tom going to read the resolution?
Sure, we can. The resolution that was in the packet, chair has summarized it. And if there's specific questions, we can.
I'd like to open it up to the rest of our members if they have any comments on the resolution or the conversations that were held. Any hands raised?
Vice Chair Beeman Jacinto does have her hand raised.
Okay. Vice Chair Jacinto.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for that great overview and background. The only bit that I just want to add from the subcommittee is that this resolution really reflects a lot of work, and it's meant to reflect the input of the entire committee from last meeting as well. And it took a lot of compromise and working together to come to this language that I think will provide the, you know, the foundation and the unity that everyone wants to see in our communities as we move forward in the conversation on public safety. So just great work to everyone. And thank you, Chair, for your leadership. And also to former Chair Pena, not here, but because his leadership was really critical in this as well.
Okay, and do we have any other hands raised?
We do, Chair. Chief Probation Officer Miller, as well as Mayor Pro Tem Kelly, have their hand raised.
Okay, let's start with Mr. Miller.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. This is a very important resolution. I will tell you that probation very much is concerned about this field. I know the county has passed a resolution on systemic racism being a public health crisis. As you may know, we supervise about 12,000 adults currently countywide. On any given year, we service a total of about 20,000 adult individuals and right now about 1,000 youth countywide. We see a lot of inequities and really are striving to work with our county and community partners to reduce those inequities and to give those individuals who come through the criminal justice system the best opportunity to gain some stability in their personal lives, to get some traction, to get back on their feet and get moving in the right direction. So we fully support this effort. Thank you.
Thank you for what you do, Mr. Miller. Councilmember Kelly.
I want to thank the subcommittee and everyone who worked with you. You listed some very ambitious goals when you started your introduction. And my feedback is that I think you achieved them all. When I opened up the agenda packet and looked at the resolution, I was extremely impressed. So I commend all of you for your difficult work. And once again, I think it reflects what the Coachella Valley can accomplish when we work together.
Thank you for your comments, Councilmember Kelly. Yes, it was a collaborative effort, but at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. We all want equality. We all want our families to be safe. And we also want to go home at the end of the day. And I have a very diverse perspective, being that I'm African-American, and I'm an 18-year veteran in California Department of Corrections. And also, just to put this out there, I started my career at College of the Desert, and I've taken classes through Riverside County. I've had the honor of starting my career with Chief Reyes in Palm Springs, teaching a couple of my classes or being a guest speaker. So, Coachella Valley is really one big city. And if we all come together and listen to folks, I know we could do this. And I understand that, you know, some folks don't want unity and peace, but the vast majority of us do. And that's where my hope lies. So if there is no further hands raised, Erica, I'd like to ask for a motion.
Move to approve.
Second.
Okay, well, we have a motion by Vice Chair Jacinto and a second by Councilmember Kelly. Do we need to do a roll call vote, or we could just
you can, or you can do a summary vote.
We'll do a summary vote. All right.
I would encourage members though to say it verbally for the audio record, please.
Rancho Moreno. Yes.
Yes.
County, yes.
I'm Desert, yes.
Yes.
Cathedral City, yes.
Desert Hot Springs,
yes. Could have done a roll call.
Okay. Well, you know, it looks like it passes. I don't think anybody, any nays. So thank you. A lot of hard work, and I'm very proud of the resolution for my first meeting as the chair. And so we'll move on to item number 9, which is information, which is your attendance record and transition of Coachella Valley Housing First operation. And the next item will be public comment for non-agenda items. And if we have any hands raised or any folks in the public who'd like to make comments.
I see none, Chair.
We'll see none. So, okay. So we'll move along to number 11, and which is announcements. And that's our upcoming Public Safety Committee meetings, which would be Monday, January 11th, 2021 at 9 a.m. And also Executive Committee meeting Monday, December 7th, 2020 at 4:30 p.m. If we have no further comments, I will adjourn the meeting at 10:01 a.m. for the record.
Bye all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone, take care.
Thank you all. Be safe also.
Thank you.